These days, Gerald Felix Warburg is a professor of public policy and assistant dean at the University of Virginia's Frank Batten School of Leadership and Public Policy. But for over 30 years, he lived in Washington, D.C., working as a legislative assistant with members of Congress and as a senior manager at a government relations firm. In his new book, Dispatches from the Eastern Front of Political Education from the Nixon Years to the Age of Obama, Professor Warburg relates his experiences. And it's in a book published by Bancroft Press. I'm very pleased that it brings Gerald Warburg to our show today. Hello.
Thanks very much for having me. Great to be here.
That title, Dispatches from the Eastern Front, sounds like the title of a war story. Is D.C. or American politics a field of battle?
Well, I grew up on the West Coast with family from this neighborhood. And when I went back east, I felt like a voyager to a foreign land, particularly as a young idealistic man from Hampshire College in Washington, D.C. And so I was reporting on the strange ways of folks by the Potomac.
Were people there looking at you as having come from the left coast, as some people used to describe the West Coast?
I think that's true. I think also even in those days, coming from Hampshire College with Ken Burns' class and some other folks, we were a little bit offbeat. But we were idealistic and we thought we could get stuff done.
How did you end up in Washington?
I actually tell the story in the book. I sat around in the salon at Hampshire College talking about how we were going to save the world. It was after the fall of Nixon, and the civil rights movement and the Vietnam War, anti-war movement were sort of running out of steam, and we were really, frankly, looking for a purpose. And the sense was that all major decisions were being made in Washington. And with Nixon's fall 40 years ago this summer, there was opportunities to move the nation forward.
But you were a college student.
I was a college kid, and the idea I could be involved in these things was quite presumptuous.
Most accounts of the dynamics of Washington are from journalists or politicians. Did you want to provide an alternative picture of Washington in the form of a memoir here?
I really did. I found myself fascinated by the people, and I wanted to explore the interior landscape. The best political memoir I'd ever read was by a guy named Harry McPherson, who came to Washington with LBJ. And he would write, as I did at night or during filibusters or quorum calls, his impressions of the individuals on both sides of the aisle and tried to figure out what made all these 4-H club presidents tick.
You were keeping notes all along with the intention someday of writing this book?
The dispatches from the Eastern Front were actually letters home to my mother and brothers out in California. And I had no intention whatsoever of publishing it. But I was trying to reflect on, as I said, the interior landscape. What made a Howard Baker tick? What made a Ronald Reagan tick? What made Nancy Pelosi tick? And I was observing the people really as characters in a play.
Do you think you ever figured out what made them tick?
That's a fair question. I should ask my readers after they've been through the book. But my sense is I did, that there was a combination of egotistical self-centeredness, but also an idealism that goes right back to the founding fathers, that we citizens can make a difference and that the government is not some alien other. So I came to like some people, and I came to like some of the folks who I disagreed with very strongly politically. I tell a story of Julie Nixon Eisenhower in the book, who I think the world of. And yet you wouldn't think, growing up in an anti-Nixon household in California, that I would have much in common with her. But
yeah, well, she's been a guest on the show. She's a very charming person.
She's a fascinating person and loyal to a fault, but also a very thoughtful and progressive person.
Over the years, which members of Congress did you work for?
I worked first with Jonathan Bingham of the Bronx, a wonderful legislator who worked with Averell Harriman before that. And we worked together on nuclear arms control, and he was a great hero of the reform effort.
And you were a college kid at the time?
I had just gotten my newly minted degree from Hampshire College. I was the ripe old age of 22, and we worked on some nuclear reform legislation, which remarkably passed. And he became the hero of the movement to control nuclear exports. And in fact, we have not sold a reactor since Jack Bingham's bill passed in 1978 overseas.
But you had been an intern for John Tunney, hadn't you? The son of the famous boxer Gene Tunney?
I did, and I found him to be a fascinating character. I wrote in the book that he was someone that really had to be taught to dissemble. He was not a natural politician. He was a guy who could come on your show, Leonard, and have a conversation, and he had all kinds of handlers around him. You might think of maybe Mr. Cantor's downfall last week, where you have a lot of handlers around a guy. But he was a wonderful person to work for. But then I worked for Jack Bingham, and then I worked for Alan Cranston, the Senate Majority Whip, for many years.
Wasn't Tunney media savvy? He conducted a weekly radio report and often interviewed other members of Congress for it.
I'm just telling you honestly, with the distance of 40 years, I don't think he liked the spotlight. I think all his handlers liked the spotlight. He was famously caricatured in The Candidate. Robert Redford played John Tunney as the inevitable candidate who would go from anti-war senator with good looks to become president. John Tunney's much happier in private life right now, years later. I don't think he really liked being on 24/7. So it's interesting he was an interviewer.
Interesting also that he defeated George Murphy, pretty famous Republican, and then was defeated by S.I. Hayakawa.
He was defeated in a race that was very much akin to the Cantor race last week. Nobody saw it coming. Nobody expected it. Tunney's presidential campaign was already being organized. And as I said, John Tunney, I don't think really liked the life of the Senate cloakroom and the conference committee rooms, and he was ill-suited to it, much happier in another world.
My guest is Gerald Felix Warburg. His book, Dispatches from the Eastern Front of Political Education from the Nixon Years to the Age of Obama, it's published by Bancroft Press. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Ludit Lopate. You returned to work in Washington again, this time for Senator Alan Cranston, another Democrat from California. You obviously had been bitten by the bug, but did you aspire to anything other than working for people who are already in office?
No, I really did not have an interest in standing before the voters at 7 a.m. and eating scrambled eggs four times in four different town hall meetings. I loved the fact that I was close to power and that I could influence great events. I was involved with Soviet refuseniks, nuclear arms control with the Soviet Union with Alan Cranston, in the leadership in the center of the well. But I like to work my ideas in the legislation, not in public speeches.
And even though you were young, they respected your ideas?
I found that Washington was remarkably open and accessible, and it's counterintuitive in this environment to say that, Leonard, but I consider it an extraordinarily accessible place. You can walk in, and if you have a decent idea and half a clue about how to advance it, people will listen.
Wasn't Senator Cranston found to be a little too accessible? Were you working for him when he became one of the Keating Five? That also included John Glenn, John McCain, that got caught up in the savings and loan crisis?
Alan worked for almost 30 years in Washington. Towards the end of his career, he was caught up in a scandal. Everybody else was excused, and the one guy who was retiring, they saw fit to come down hard on. I do write about it in the book. I was not present, not involved in that stuff. But yeah, I think the longer people stay in Washington, it's hard to keep your friends from the folks who want something from you.
Although today, the courts might defend Charles Keating's political contributions as protected speech.
Don't get me started on the court. I think we all know as intelligent citizens that corporations are not people and money is not free speech. And if we have one thing we need to fix before we fix anything else, I'd start there. I say often that the founding fathers would be appalled by this situation. I don't like hearing strict constructionists say that the founding fathers would do nothing. They were tinkerers. They wouldn't stand for this. They'd fix it in a moment.
The public doesn't hear a great deal about the role of congressional staffers. How important are they? Are they like the law clerks for the Supreme Court justices?
With all due respect to the court, I'd say they're more powerful. I think that when you have a 4,000-page bill that's written in a 36-hour period with a lot of coffee, the members do not read the bill. The staffers write the bill. They're trying to carry out the intention of the members.
So they draft the legislation?
They draft the legislation.
Obviously working for somebody who tells them, this is what I want, or do they throw in their own ideas as well?
More the former than the latter, Leonard, is the best practice. But a member tells them where you want to go, and the staffer knows how to get there, what statutes have to be amended, and how to put in language that will really lock it down. And it is an extraordinary sense of power for young people involved in public service to be able to have that kind of influence.
Because you said earlier you were working on very big legislation, the kind that we don't see much anymore.
It's one of my greatest disappointments as someone who teaches every day at the Batten School at the University of Virginia. I'm trying to empower these kids to next month, next week, go in and make a difference. And we do not have a Congress that is consequential right now. And our system is broken. So to inspire people to go get involved in this process is sometimes a bit of an uphill swim.
Do you think part of it is that although we have some very prominent people in Congress, they don't have the kind of celebrity status that we saw with Claude Pepper or Robert Byrd or Tip O'Neill, Strom Thurmond, Millicent Fenwick?
With all due respect, I think it's the any man, the any woman who can go in and really make a difference. The fact is we have to exercise these muscles of legislating in order to get stuff done. And the more serious the problems are, frankly, the more opportunities there are to move stuff. And the fact that Congress, you have an ironic situation where a Congress that detests Obama is giving him more and more power by not acting and therefore opening the field for executive action. I find that very ironic that the Tea Party has done that.
Well, isn't this something that actually the ball started rolling a long time ago as presidents took on more and more executive power? I remember speaking to a historian once about this. I said, well, would any president say, I want less executive power? It just keeps on expanding because that seems to be the way things are.
But if you go back to 74 and when I showed up as a 21-year-old kid, you had a situation where the power had drifted through the LBJ presidency, the so-called imperial presidency of LBJ and Nixon. But Congress pulled it back, and it pulled it back because men and women saw a common interest in upholding what the founders wanted and having a strong legislature.
I don't think Frank Church would even be elected to Congress these days.
And not from Idaho. But you did have people like Howard Baker he could work with across the aisle.
Can the any man or any woman win elections these days with the amounts of money that's needed to run?
Yes.
Unless your name is Brat?
Just ask Professor Brat. The idea of
but
professor.
He may not win the final election.
I think that district has been so heavily gerrymandered for the Republicans, it would have to be another case of political malpractice for him to lose. But I frankly think it's refreshing. And I think maybe misleading that somebody can come in with no money and win like that. I don't like to see people dropping $100 million into elections like Mr. Adelson or Mr. Steyer. I don't think that's in the best American tradition.
From 1991 to 2007, you worked at Cassidy & Associates, the government relations firm. What kind of work does Cassidy do, and what were you doing there?
It was the biggest lobbying firm in town at the time. I had a wonderful experience. I didn't expect to like it. Most of my clients were nonprofits. They were states and cities and counties, primarily from my home state of California, who thought they could partner with the federal government to get stuff done. So we were pursuing earmarks for breast cancer research and bridges and base cleanups when the military pulled out of the San Francisco Bay Area. And while I didn't have a lot of respect for lobbyists on the Hill, surprise, when the tables turned, I thought we could actually add something to the process.
Didn't Jack Abramoff work for a time at Cassidy?
Not when I was there.
In 2007, Robert Kaiser at the Washington Post argued that Cassidy helped turn lobbying into big business forever, transforming how politics and policy are practiced in Washington.
Bob's a good reporter, and in that sense, he's right. Lobbying has changed the environment in Washington a great deal.
You were part of the team at Cassidy that persuaded the U.S. government to allow Taiwanese President Li Teng-hui to come to the United States in 1994. What happened there?
It was a fascinating case. Growing up in San Francisco, a liberal family, I was ferociously anti-communist, and we were hired by the folks on Taiwan using the argument that if they let Jerry Adams and Yasser Arafat come to the United States, why can't the democratically elected president of Taiwan who went to Cornell come to the United States? So we used that argument as a way of pointing out the lack of human rights in China and tried to get more visibility for Taiwan.
China is a lot more powerful now than it was 20 years ago. If China were to oppose a Taiwanese president's visit today, would it be possible to change the U.S. government's position?
I really don't think so, Leonard. I think that the power has grown. That was a high water mark for Taiwan. It did get some visibility around the world that they're a democratic country with a vigorous free press, and that was a good thing. But it wouldn't happen today.
You mentioned that you had some negative feelings about lobbying. With the efforts of the Koch brothers and others, there's a growing concern over big money in Washington. Is the problem of money distinct from any problems with lobbying?
I would be even more specific, and I have many, many friends in the Congress. I think the problem is the members themselves. They're addicted to the lobbyist money, left, right, liberal, conservative. That's the first 25% of their campaign cash comes from the lobbyists. If you passed a law that no one doing business before the federal government could give a nickel, it would change the environment immediately. And many of us in the profession would have supported it then. I'm now a political science professor. I think it'd be a great thing.
There have been attempts to push things back, and little by little, they've been nibbled away.
It's one of the sad truths that the McCain-Feingold reforms have now been so overtaken by events and by the sea of money. But I would then probably fall back on Professor Bratt. You can come into a situation. You can operate at the grassroots, left or right. And I frankly think as a liberal, it's the best thing about the Tea Party. They demonstrate the tradition of grassroots activism in the United States.
My guest is Gerald Felix Warburg, professor of public policy and assistant dean of the Frank Batten School of Leadership and Public Policy at the University of Virginia. His book, Dispatches from the Eastern Front, A Political Education from the Nixon Years to the Age of Obama, published by Bancroft Press. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We are back to Gerald Felix Warburg. His book, Dispatches from the Eastern Front, A Political Education from the Nixon Years to the Age of Obama. It is published by Bancroft Press. We were talking about money as a problem in Washington, and Mark Leibovitz in This Town says that people in Washington are addicted to money. In fact, he's not optimistic about Washington politicians or journalists. Have you read his book?
I have, and I'm not as pessimistic as he is. I think these problems are familiar, known, and remediable. It's a combination of the fundraising and the gerrymandering.
But he also argues that a growing number of members of Congress are there to enrich themselves, and now for the first time in American history, a majority of members of Congress are millionaires.
Well, I think that's why we need more grassroots activism left and right. That's why we can take some heart in a vote of no confidence in the leadership in the very peculiar primary race the other day in Virginia. But the founders' idea was that we would be refreshing the talent regularly, and we need to send more NGO activists and young people to Washington to turn it over.
Is the Tea Party really a grassroots movement? Isn't it? Hasn't been pointed out that a lot of its funding has come from groups like Americans for Progress, which is funded by the Koch brothers.
I share your concern there, and I share very much your concern about what the Koch brothers' money does. And yet I would note that what happened in the Virginia Congressional District the other day was not directed by any national money pot. In fact, they turned their backs on this guy. They thought he was too far right, which made political malpractice of Mr. Cantor's staff running ads saying he was a liberal college professor. It was just silly.
But some of the talk show hosts like Laura Ingraham were really behind Brad.
I think that was the major wind in his sails, was having the right-wing talk radio folks behind him.
After decades in Washington, you're now at the University of Virginia. Do you think there's anything that political scientists systematically miss with all their mathematical methods and models?
There's a loaded question. We have great debates about that around the faculty at UVA because I think it's the personal element that's really missing. I used to be a baseball pitcher, and you could run all the stats you wanted, but I needed to remember what pitch I'd gotten the guy out with last time up and whether I wanted to pitch backwards or forwards. I think they miss the human element. I think they miss what goes on down in the well in the Senate when folks trade votes. I worked with Ted Kennedy and Alan Cranston on the anti-apartheid legislation, and they made a number of trades in order to get the Republicans and Dick Lugar to override President Reagan's veto on that. The quantitative stuff that political scientists do, it's very hard to pick up that kind of personal interaction.
Lawrence Tribe was here recently, and he's somewhat skeptical about the ingenious mathematical models political scientists use to study the Supreme Court. So political scientists are using mathematical models to study everything. How do they work?
I think they miss the human element, which is about 87% of politics.
And that's what you wanted to do with this book?
I wanted to put a narrative arc to these efforts to move the country forward by talking about the personalities. The one thing that people always ask me when they saw me sitting between the majority leader and the majority whip on the Senate floor is, what are they talking about down there? What are they saying to each other? And what they were saying was so very human and so very direct and so very compromisable. You could come up with a common ground is what I'm trying to say, Leonard.
Are they talking that way anymore?
Oh, they can't be seen talking to each other. People Mr. Cantor's people ran a picture of Mr. Bratt with the Democratic Senator Kane, spent $2 million giving him name recognition, just the fact that they're in the same room together. It is a hazard. And it's why the remedies will come from the political center.
Why did Congress work better 30 to 40 years ago? Was Newt Gingrich responsible for all the problems?
I can't blame it all on Newt, as some of my Democratic friends would like to. I think the 24-hour news cycle is an enormous thing to overcome. The fact that you could work on a deal for 2 or 3 days and you could come up with common ground, like on the anti-apartheid legislation, which was consequential, which made a real difference. But Kennedy had to give some, Cranston had to give some, Lugar had to give some, and then the Republicans overrode Reagan. None of those four things would happen in this environment. You need the centrists. You need the people who can work across the aisle, come up with a common ground, stand up to the executive, stand up to the big money, and move stuff. And it does happen.
You've observed Congress through several presidencies. Have the attitudes of senators and representatives changed toward the presidency?
They've gotten more scornful of the president and yet less willing to stand up to the office. And I point out the fact, the irony, that a results-oriented movement like the Tea Party has given so much power to a liberal administration, Obama-Biden, by doing nothing in Congress.
Were they as scornful toward the Bush administration?
No. Both Bush the father and Bush the son had more supporters in Congress. Famously, George Miller, the Democratic Party, worked with Mr. Bush on No Child Left Behind. George Herbert Walker Bush had many friends who were Democrats, worked with them, called them up, listened to them after hours. There's not that type of exchange. And while I'm sympathetic to a number of the Obama-Biden policies, that's something I would find fault with the president on.
It has been pointed out that for many years, whether we had a Republican or a Democrat in the White House, Congress was pretty much controlled by the Democrats, and that's why certain things ran smoothly. It also has led to a lot of resentment among Republicans because they felt that the Democrats often rode roughshod over them. Is that what we would want to return to?
No, we do not want to return to that. And I'll give you an example. A guy like Tim Kaine, very progressive guy against capital punishment from Virginia, he won't introduce a bill without a Republican co-sponsor. And that used to be the way we would operate. Jack Bingham from New York, a big New York delegation of Democrats, he wouldn't put in bills without a Republican on it. Cranston wouldn't travel without a Republican.
Would it be hard to find a Republican to co-sponsor a bill today, even if you knew the Republican agreed with you?
I think we're right at the tipping point of the nadir, where you're going to have more and more Democrats and Republicans willing to work across the aisle. I think the last few months have really been the bottom. I think we're bottoming out. I think we're on an uptick.
Well, the defeat of Eric Cantor might suggest otherwise, because one of the arguments against him was that he was willing to work with the Democrats rather reluctantly, but he still was, for example, on the debt ceiling.
Indeed. I've said to many friends that I think Mr. Cantor's loss was good for the Democrats, bad for the Republicans, and worse for the country. I think some people will mistakenly see that as an excuse for doing nothing in Congress and just being a blocking mechanism for the next 3 years. But I think Republicans do that at their own peril.
Do you see a lot of variation between the private personas and the public face that people in Congress present to the public? There's that predictable public posturing to please voters, but I'm wondering whether they're sincere. Do they really dislike each other as much as it appears that they do?
Well, back in the day, they didn't. These days, they are taught to consider the other side the enemy, just as voters are unfortunately taught that government is some alien other. Whereas when I grew up in California, government was a very positive force in our lives in the 50s and 60s and the Wonder Years. But now the vilification has gone pretty far. But these folks know each other. They travel together. They work out in the gym together. They talk to each other. I think the vilification will become less, not more.
My guest is Gerald Felix Warburg. His book, Dispatches from the Eastern Front, Political Education from the Nixon Years to the Age of Obama. Policy on Israel has remained sensitive for 40 years or so. You described senators' responses when Israel invaded Lebanon in 1982. How big a difference was there between the subdued public criticism and the private responses?
It was a very upsetting instance, and I retell a story. I try to talk about my mistakes in the book, Leonard, not just the good things that politicians write about themselves. It was very profound. It was very upsetting to me because I heard the senators very critical of Israel in private. As many of us who loved Israel thought they had gone way, way, way too far and needed to be pulled back by people who cared about them. But in public, they were unwilling to be critical of Israel. I was very proud of my boss, Alan Cranston, when he chose to do so. I thought it was in the national interest. But
that's despite the fact that your family has a long history of supporting Jewish causes.
I think that is not at all inconsistent with calling Begin to heel for what he was doing in Lebanon with American arms. I think that was done out of love, not calling him to heel, not disagreement.
Listeners hearing your name might wonder whether you're related to the cellist and conductor Gerald Felix Warburg, whose father was Felix Moritz Warburg, the banker, in fact, an advocate for the Federal Reserve Bank.
Indeed. I'm named after my very proud of my grandpa. Gerald Warburg was a cellist, lived just uptown. But I grew up with the California Warburgs. We're sort of proud of the fact we all went to public school and were involved in a time in California when public service was a very noble calling.
So you were not in line to inherit the Warburg Mansion here in New York that is now the home to the Jewish Museum.
Indeed, I was not, and I'm proud to pay admission when I go up to visit. It's a wonderful facility.
The U.S. has had a lot of political families, the Clintons, the Bushes, the Cheneys, the Cuomos, the Kennedys, of course. Do you see any problems in the fact that so many relations wind up running for office? Right now, we're hearing about the next generation of Bushes, for example, that we've had the next generation of Kennedys in politics.
I do. I think that Hamilton and Jefferson would have agreed that we're not creating an aristocracy here. And I think there's plenty of good candidates in both parties without going back to those families who've given so much to public service. So I do have a problem with that. I think you get a little bit of Bush fatigue and the idea of picking apart another Bush's immigration policy is not something I'm enthusiastic about.
What about the other side, the politicians who stay in office for a long time? Strom Thurmond was in office for 47 years, Alan Cranston, 24 years, Robert Byrd, 51 years. Can a politician's tenure be too long?
Yes. And the Supreme Court as well. We do have this wonderful device for term limits. It's called elections. And I think if we reduce the powers of incumbency and we get honest about the gerrymandering and we don't let politicians in the House pick their own voters, which is just an absurd situation, I think we could remedy a lot of that. But I'm not in favor of folks who show up at 21 and stay until they're 96. I think that's a bit much.
The Pew Research Center has just released a study that indicates that Americans are far more polarized politically than we were just 20 years ago. And some academics have argued that Americans are not actually all that polarized. Do you think that that political scientists are just missing something?
I think there's a generational split here. I think we of a certain age are comfortable living around folks who agree with us and have the same marketing habits. I'll tell you, the young people, Leonard, that I teach at the University of Virginia are flaming moderates. They're a little bit skeptical of the power of government to do be a positive force in their life, but they are not as polarized as the parents are, and I hold out hope that they will bring a new sense of energy to public service.
On the other hand, it's been pointed out that most of those people will not be voting in the midterm elections, and that will have a real impact on who gets elected.
Well, I can't.
Why do you think they're not going to vote?
I think there's a terrible tradition in this country of showing out in the turning out in the presidential years and not in the off years, and I think that'll obviously be the key issue for the House and Senate in 2014. But I do hope that some of the new technologies, social media, et cetera, will be able to drive people to the polls, not just from the left and right, but from the center. The stakes, frankly, are going to get higher and higher, and that's one consequence of Congress doing nothing.
In April, President Obama noted that the 113th Congress is the least productive Congress in modern history. Is the number of laws enacted or bills passed a meaningful measure of congressional productivity?
No, but it's true. It is the most inconsequential. The laws have been so strikingly below the norm, like 70 versus 500. And I'll discount that half of those were naming post offices, et cetera, and the other half were required appropriations. But to be honest with you, Congress is really not passing anything anymore. So you don't have opportunities to load on a consensus item, whether it's on climate change or
I'm not a scientist. I don't know if there is such a thing.
Don't get me started. I think that is, frankly, one issue that will move the center of the country very vigorously over the next generation to be more proactive and involved in government policy, i.e. combating climate change, which is a fact, sir.
Small government conservatives have argued that a Congress that legislates least governs best.
They're wrong. Think back to the founding fathers, who they like to quote so much, the strict constructionists. They were experimenters. They were tinkerers. They changed the Articles of Confederation wholesale within 13 years, and they passed 10 amendments to the Constitution before it was even adopted. They believed in the power of government to be a progressive force in our lives, whether they were liberal or conservative. Hamilton himself agreed with these things.
Are conservatives today any more conservative than Strom Thurmond or Jesse Helms were, or the equivalent? Are liberals today any more liberal than the liberals of the 60s and 70s were?
I don't think so, except in one respect. There's been a degrading, not just of public service, which I've said before, but of the idea that our community, which is our government, we pay their salary, men and women, that it can be a positive force in our lives. Conservatives saw ways that the government could advance certain things, not necessarily by spending money, perhaps by giving more liberty. But that is a change in the conservative movement, the idea that the government is the enemy. The government's us. It's our neighbors.
And it could be counterproductive for Mississippi, where Thad Cochran is endangered right now, despite the fact that he has brought so much money into Mississippi. They get $3 for every dollar they send to the government, and he's being attacked for that.
Indeed, and I'll give you Virginia, where the three most powerful Republicans in the state have all gone down in the last year, Governor McDonnell, Majority Leader Cantor, and Mr. Wolf from the Appropriations Committee. They've lost 100 years' worth of seniority, so to speak.
Will anything change until we can get rid of gerrymandering, or gerrymandering, as some insist?
I think a combination of focus on gerrymandering and campaign finance reform will bring about those term limits that we all hope for, which are called elections.
Gerald Felix Warburg, his book, Dispatches from the Eastern Front, A Political Education from the Nixon Years to the Age of Obama. It's published by Bancroft Press. Thank you so much for being on our show today. It's been a real pleasure.
It's a delight to be here. Thank you so much for caring about books.